This is The Guardian.
Mit Asana ist KI nicht mehr nur ein Tool, sondern ein Teammitglied. Jetzt hilft Asana AI Ihnen, Ihre Ziele besser zu erreichen und verknüpft sie mit relevanten Projekten, damit alles planmäßig verläuft. So arbeiten Ihre Teams intelligenter und schneller. Asana, die führende Plattform für KI-gestütztes Workmanagement. Jetzt kostenlos testen auf asana.com. asana.com.
In Norway, a woman's boyfriend forgets who she is overnight. In Detroit, a man is arrested, but he was never at the crime scene. In Spain, disturbing pictures of young girls have appeared, and no one knows who's behind them. Something strange is happening. A collision between people and artificial intelligence.
Discover more in The Guardian's series, Black Box. Listen to the whole series right now, wherever you get your podcasts.
The final report of the inquiry into the Grenfell Tower fire was published this week, and it found that decades of failure by successive governments led to that disaster.
The simple truth is that the deaths that occurred were all avoidable.
The Prime Minister says this is a watershed moment.
Mr. Speaker, today is a long-awaited day of truth, but it must now lead to a day of justice.
But after 7 years, will anything actually change? And Parliament's back, but the government's mood is far from positive.
But I'm absolutely determined to ensure that working people are better off. Under the last government, the tax burden reached its highest level in 70 years.
Is a painful period of Labour austerity the only route through? I'm John Harris, and you're listening to Politics Week in the UK for The Guardian. Sir Martin Moore-Bick published his final report into the Grenfell disaster on Wednesday. In it, he said that the simple truth is that all of the deaths caused were avoidable and that people in Grenfell Tower were badly failed over a number of years in a number of different ways by those who were responsible for the safety of the building and the people who lived in it.
The simple truth is that the deaths that occurred were all avoidable and those who lived in the tower were badly failed over a number of years and in a number of different ways by those who were responsible for ensuring the safety of the building and its occupants. Not all of them bear the same degree of responsibility for the eventual disaster, but as our reports show, all contributed to it in one way or another, in most cases through incompetence, but in some cases through dishonesty and greed.
Susanna Rustin is The Guardian's social affairs leader writer and has been writing for a long time about the Grenfell disaster. Susanna, before we get into the findings of this report, you live near the site of the disaster and you know people who were affected. Can you just tell us a bit about that?
I live in Westminster, not in Kensington, but just across the border of the borough. And my children were at one of the North Kensington primary schools that were affected by the disaster. Not one of the very closest schools, where they had sort of ash raining down on the playground, and there were schools that lost whole families. But our school was one that was just close enough to have families where children had lost relatives. And you know, we walked to school the morning of the after the fire, when just a few hours after the last person had been rescued, and we could see it was still smoking. And I'll never forget that morning when we got to the school gates, all the staff were standing there and it was just completely silent. It was overwhelming. I'll never forget it.
And the legacy since? I ask you that because people who don't live in close proximity to perhaps where it happened won't necessarily have a sense of how much what happened maybe still defines that part of London.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm, you know, far enough away that I don't feel I'm, you know, part of that community. I feel I'm part of a neighbouring community. So I don't want to, you know, be presumptuous. But, you know, it's a tower block, obviously, and we still see it all the time, the supermarket car park. You know, the main local secondary school, the one that most of the children from my children's primary school went to, was part of the same development as Grenfell Tower itself. You know, the refurbishment of the tower followed on from the building of this new leisure centre and secondary school. So it absolutely is. It's kind of part of the physical infrastructure and the landscape and, of course, the social infrastructure, the community. You know, so many people have been directly and less directly affected.
Tell me, as you understand it, the key things the report says, and perhaps the key things that the report doesn't say.
So the report blames decades of regulatory failure and systematic dishonesty by construction firms. And that's the kind of broad brush. And then in a bit more detail, it singles out numerous organisations, from the tenant management organisation that the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea used to run its social housing, to numerous sort of public and private sort of certificate, building certification and inspectorates.
And in terms of the politics, both with a small and large P of all this, clearly that's a huge part of the story. The report says there were many opportunities to address the risk posed by flammable cladding that were missed by governments from the early 1990s onwards, culminating in decades of failure. That's a phrase used in the report. And we all know that this disaster happened in an atmosphere in which, as a matter of consensus, the idea of deregulating everything, the idea of stripping local government of any ability to do much at all, right, was fairly constant through this period. What's your sense then of those things and where they sit in the report?
So it's absolutely clear that the coalition and David Cameron, under David Cameron's prime ministership, you know, that was key, that period where there was a bonfire of red tape and they had specific rules about, you know, tearing up rules and not making new regulations unless you could get rid of old regulations. So that was a very strong sort of ideological climate, which civil servants talked about as having sort of shaped their extremely poor decision making. And obviously the council was also conservative, like the Prime Minister, and Eric Pickles, who was an important figure running the Department for Communities, which has a lot of is responsible for housing, and the council was basically signed up to the same sort of deregulatory ideology.
The words of the report about the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea Council are quite striking. A persistent indifference to fire safety, particularly the safety of vulnerable people.
Yeah, I'm glad you pulled out that phrase. I mean, you sort of read that, you know, the idea that a council that is responsible for providing housing could be indifferent to fire safety. It's just breathtakingly awful. You know, one of the details that's always stayed with me is that the flats didn't have closing fire doors. I mean, imagine living in a 24-storey building and having a flat door that didn't have an automatic closing device. You know, I think we all know from hotels or any buildings that, you know, multiple occupancy, that's just a basic.
There are huge, huge questions that sit under this about Britain as a whole as well, about social housing, about class, about government, about questions about race and ethnicity, clearly as well, right? Let me ask you a more direct question, which is about accountability. This is one of those moments which is sort of framed as some kind of reckoning, right, of some description. My sense already is that people don't feel that that's what's going to happen here.
I think that there's, you know, there's different forms of accountability, aren't there? And I think that by sort of naming and shaming individual firms and public bodies, the expectation is that the police and Crown Prosecution Service have said that they're waiting for this inquiry report before they make any decisions about charges. I think the question is really whether they will secure convictions, because any, you know, corporate manslaughter charges are very difficult to bring and to prove. But and then also, you know, questions about whether the kind of individuals, whether it's the people that were really responsible for the cultures, for the practices, for the decision making, will ever really be held to account, or whether if anybody does get sent to prison, it'll be some sort of, you know, rather junior sort of hopeless person who certainly didn't do a good job, but isn't really the sort of, you know, isn't the sort of architect of the disaster, if you like. I think that remains to be seen. I don't want to sort of prejudge that, but I certainly, you know, you don't get the feeling that there's great confidence that justice is around the corner.
But irrespective of the report, everybody knows what happened and the issues that it highlighted. And you and I both know that 7 years on from this, only a matter of what, days or weeks ago, there was a fire at a tower block in Dagenham involving identical or similar cladding, right? So it's not like we aren't sitting here after 7 years of failure, really. That's what it feels like.
Yeah, I think the failure to remove cladding or to make, you know, it's all over the place. You know, it's absolutely a sort of endemic problem. There are some new rules. You know, it can't any longer be, this form of flammable cladding can't any longer be put on buildings more than 18 metres tall. So some things have changed, thanks to the campaigners. I mean, I think they've waged a heroic campaign, really, because obviously they want justice for themselves and their loved ones. But like so many people who've been affected by one of these great sort of public tragedies, they're also trying to do something in, you know, more generally in the public good to prevent something awful happening again in future. And I think so that their losses and their tragedies don't feel meaningless, so that something good can come out of everything that's gone wrong. So I think some, you know, there have been some positive changes and one has to sort of hold on to that. But I, you know, it's nowhere near enough.
I mean, that leads me on to the final two questions, really. You say it's nowhere near enough. So to what extent does this represent a just outcome?
The inquiry itself?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think at all. I mean, I think it could only ever be seen as a sort of one stage. I mean, I think it's an accounting in terms of its sort of findings of truth. It's an investigation, but it's not a process that is set up to deliver justice. It's only set up to deliver recommendations. So I think a huge amount now depends on what the government does. And I think that is going to be tremendously political, because obviously the government is determined to build a lot of housing.
Well, it's determined that someone else should build a lot of housing.
Exactly. It's one of its, most important commitments. So its relationship with the construction industry, a lot is going to depend on the government's relationship with the construction industry. And this report is absolutely damning of the construction industry. And one of the recommendations is for a new construction industry regulator. Everything we've learned about the kind of way that the industry operates, the way it lobbies, you know, the way that some companies have, you know, deliberately falsified and misrepresented materials, it does not inspire confidence.
But also, this is a slightly crass sort of simplistic point, but it seems worth making, which is that if you are going to come anywhere near rectifying or correcting those underlying systemic things that sit behind this tragedy, you're going to have to spend money, the government I'm talking about, it seems to me. And we both know the moment that we're in, which is that, notwithstanding the fact this is a Labour government, the message is there isn't any money. Things are only going to get worse before they get better. I mean, Keir Starmer has said that directly. That's a very awkward context for this report to sit in, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And the recommendations of the report, you know, just such as the one I just mentioned about a construction regulator, you know, that's a big new sort of governmental body, you know, something like the media regulator or something that, you know, would require staff and trade, you know, and good staff, because these are hard jobs.
But if you don't want social housing and the people who live in it to be sort of residualised and at the bottom of everyone's concerns, you know, if you want to restore the status and importance of social housing, that seems to be one of the things that the government has sort of explicitly said it's not going to be able to do for a long time.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's very politically difficult. One of the other things that's been mentioned is that the companies that were directly involved in the refurbishment of Grenfell and found to be at fault in the way they carried out that work should be barred from bidding in future for public contracts. That seems to me entirely reasonable. Arconic, which is the company that made the flammable cladding, which was found to be the main cause of the fire spreading, refused to even participate in the public inquiry, refused to send witnesses and so on. And I really think it's questionable whether a company that won't cooperate with the British legal system, of which the public inquiries are part, should be able to operate at all.
I was going to say they shouldn't be in business, never mind public contracts, they shouldn't be in business at all.
That's what I think. I think there's really a question about if companies aren't going to be agree to be accountable under the democratic and legal processes that we have, then I think that it's completely legitimate to question whether they should be entitled to do business here at all.
So in point of fact, this has probably kind of re-energised the politics around Grenfell. We are going to be hearing a lot now in the wake of this report.
I would assume so, yes. I mean, I think the government's initially done a sort of holding statement and said there'll be a more extensive debate. But the organisations representing the victims and survivors, you know, are not going to be sort of satisfied by a sort of, you know, we're very sorry for your loss and we'll think about this very carefully. They've been having that for 7 years already. It's not enough.
Thank you for speaking to us, Susanna.
Thank you.
For more coverage of the Grenfell Inquiry, our sister podcast, Today in Focus, has a special episode out on Friday where Helen Pidd will be talking to The Guardian's social affairs correspondent Rob Booth about the report and the fallout from it. Also, The Guardian's Weekend podcast is running two episodes of a recording of a play taken verbatim from the transcripts of the Grenfell Inquiry, introduced by the journalist and playwright Richard Norton Taylor. That'll be published on Saturday. You can search for both of those wherever you get your podcasts. Okay, let's pause here for a minute. When we come back, we'll be talking about a huge issue, arguably the hugest issue in British politics at the moment, the state of the public finances, the state of the public services and society, and what this new government is or isn't going to do about any of that.
In Norway, a woman's boyfriend forgets who she is overnight. In Detroit, a man is arrested, but he was never at the crime scene. In Spain, disturbing pictures of young girls have appeared, and no one knows who's behind them. Something strange is happening. A collision between people and artificial intelligence. Discover more in the Guardian series Black Box. Listen to the whole series right now, wherever you get your podcasts.
We are now going to talk about what it is fair to say will be the big defining theme of British politics for the foreseeable future. The state of our public services and the UK's social fabric. Whether this new government is going to do anything meaningful to improve those things, and if it is, how long that's going to take. We all know that the Labour Party's first budget in 14 years will be on Wednesday, the 30th of October. Rachel Reeves, the new Chancellor, says that the government cannot do what it cannot afford. And as well as laying the ground for tax rises, she and her colleagues are already putting through spending cuts to fill a supposed £22 billion black hole in the public finances. We all know how Keir Starmer cheerily decided to mark the end of summer. Let's have a listen to that.
That's what we've inherited. Not just an economic black hole, a societal black hole. And that's why we have to take action and do things differently. And part of that is being honest with people about the choices that we face, how tough this will be. And frankly, things will get worse before they get better.
So with all that in mind, we are now joined by James Medway, an economist, the host of the Macrodose podcast, and one-time advisor to the former Shadow Chancellor, John McDonnell, and Anne Pettifor, the political economist and member of the Scottish Government's Just Transition Commission, who also has a Substack, it's important that I emphasise. Right, here's the question we should start with. Tell me your level of agreement, each of you, or otherwise, with Rachel Reeves' assessment of where we are. Anne, first of all.
Yes, no, I'm largely in agreement with her.
Are you?
I'm not in agreement that things are entirely impossible, but given the way in which our system is currently constructed, and in particular the divide between fiscal policy and monetary policy, her hands really are tied. It's hard for her, A, to raise tax revenues, and she can increase taxes, of course, but whether they will be sufficient to cover the deficit is one question. But the more important question, as far as I'm concerned, is whether she can raise finance through the Bank of England.
So in other words, running a deficit of the kind that we would need to fill various gaps in public spending, let alone spend more, either on investment or on everyday revenue spending, as you see it, is very, very difficult.
I think it's difficult within that context. Yes, I think it is entirely possible. I think the Bank of England makes it virtually impossible. In two ways. First of all, the Bank of England is burdening the Treasury with something like £40 billion this year in payments owed to the Bank of England.
Okay.
Apparently.
Yeah.
And secondly, because the Bank of England's interest rates are so high in real terms that her ability to raise finance over a long term is very, very difficult.
Okay, James, where are you at as far as Rachel Reeves and the idea that all of this is inescapable and cutting and putting up taxes are things she has to do?
Well, she's right to say the economy is in a bad place, but it has been for a very long time. Beyond that, she's wrong in sort of a diagnosis, a claim of very few options, an unwillingness to explore other versions of how you might raise revenues, including things like, which she has talked about in the past, floating ideas of wealth taxes, which have been, you know, taken off the table, it seems, by this point. I also somewhat agree with Anne, although I think they probably will, around the budget, try and do something about changing the Treasury's relationship to the Bank of England, because it looks like free money, and it's quite a complicated thing that is not generally particularly well understood by people who aren't complete nerds about this, like, to be honest, and me and you. It's just something that people don't get into. And basically what's happened over the last few years is because interest rates have gone up, the Bank of England is paying out more money to various banks than it is getting back in interest via the quantitative easing program. It's a very short version of what's happened. If you simply said the Bank of England isn't paying this, you'd raise a lot more money for the Treasury because the Treasury would no longer be underwriting those costs. So it gets a bit technical, and that has the great thing for a government that if it's not very well understood, people won't necessarily ask too many questions about it.
And if that happened, just remind me, I think you've just said it, but if that happened, how much would that change the picture as regards the spending Reeves was able to do?
You could do the absolutely full whack, every single last penny that the Bank of England is claiming that the Treasury has to underwrite is now gone, and that's 40 billion. I don't think they'll do that. The more likely thing is you do some part of that, at which point it's maybe 10 billion or downwards, something around that figure. Now, that's a substantial amount of money. If they don't do it, it'll tell you something about the relationship the Treasury wants with the banking system here, which is that they want to be very, very close indeed, because this is very close to free money.
This seems to be part of a political plan. They tell us it is anyway, in terms of putting the bad news out at the beginning of the government's term in office. So the public, once again, thinks politicians are honest and are being straight with them. And then in 4 or 5 years' time, we are told, things will start to get better. How risky is that? And hard, James, let's remind ourselves, to achieve what seems to me to be their primary economic objective, which is to restore decent growth to the economy, right? That's what they say they want to do. And yet their stance is such, it seems, that they very well might not achieve it.
I mean, look, the target that they've set themselves, which is what, having the highest sustained rate of growth amongst the G7 major economies, I just find it, incredible that they're sticking to this. I mean, it's the worst possible target because most of that depends on something somebody else will do, which is the other six economies in the G7. And then to go from Britain, which has been a consistently underperforming economy since the crash, right? It's 14 odd years ago now. So you suddenly say, oh, we're now going to be the best out of this set of obvious peers. It's just implausible without that additional spending. So I don't think they're going to get that target.
Now that gets us to a very important point, which is that a long time ago when I was doing my economics A-level, I was taught economics A-level in a sort of Keynesian paradigm, right? And they taught us really that what post-war history had illustrated was that if you want to grow your economy, the government has to spend money, right? Now, it seems to me that the Starmer government is in reverse of believing the opposite, which is that if you want to spend money, you have to grow your economy. And therein lies the prospect for just sort of paralysis, really. They're going to sit there and wait for the economy to revive without really doing much about it. Is that your more pessimistic reading, Anne?
We have an economy that is entirely open, in which capital is free to flow in and out. So one of her problems, one of the problems faced by the Chancellor, is that it's really hard to tax big corporations, because in the world of capital mobility, Amazon and Google can simply shift their profits out of town and not pay their taxes in full. And that, again, deprives the state of revenue. Now, fixing that is not just fiscal policy. You know, to fix that would require monetary policy to take place. That would require the Bank of England to impose some sort of regulation, management of the movement of capital across borders.
Okay.
So that's my point, is that this is a bigger picture than just fiscal interventions.
Okay, James, in principle, presumably you would agree with that. That's right.
I do, but I also think that there's another sort of, although there's a very tight path that Rachel Reeves and the Treasury have put themselves on to sort of get through this in a way that's politically going to work, there is another sort of little path that's opened up here, which was the Office of Budget Responsibility last week. Presumably people there had also done the same A-level economics as you, produced a report on the multiplier effect, which is exactly that business of if government spends, particularly here spends to invest in capital, so you build new hospitals, you build more railway lines, you do these sort of big infrastructure spending, this has a positive effect on economic growth. This is a change to the Office of Budget Responsibility's old position, because it's now saying, actually, if you borrow to invest, there's a window that you, as a government, can make growth go up, and we will believe this will now happen. That, I think, opens up a little bit of a space where they can spend some money on capital investment and claim it as rising growth and therefore meet their own fiscal rules.
We all know about the state of the UK's social fabric and the need for money to be spent on that. And that doesn't fall under the category of capital spending, of investment spending. That's revenue spending. It's everyday spending. We all know the state that councils are in and that so many of them are either bankrupt or teetering on the brink of it. We all know there's a social care gap put at least 2 or 3 billion, possibly more annually, that needs to be filled. There will be a gap in special needs spending, educationally, of about 5 or 6 billion by 2026. GP surgeries are closing hand over fist. We all know about rusty swings, potholes in the road, litter everywhere, and all of that. Now, people's dismay and despondency about those things is part of the reason this government was elected. It's almost easy to talk about opening the way to investment spending. From your perspective, both of you, is there a way that Rachel Reeves could plug the gaps that I've talked about and spend more money on the everyday revenue stuff? Anne, first of all.
So, yes, I mean, I don't agree with this divide between capital and revenue.
It seems arbitrary to me, yeah.
You can invest in physical infrastructure. You can build roads or bridges or whatever. But at the same time, it's possible to invest in social infrastructure. And the point that James was trying to make, which is a really important point, is that if you invest in any activity which increases employment, and you and I know this from our own experience, that generates income for the person employed. It generates income, yes, for shopkeepers, but it also generates income revenue for the Treasury. So the point about this is that it's wrong to make a distinction in terms of the income generated for the state between capital and if you like, social infrastructure.
James, just tell me about your take on this question about everyday public services spending. Some people think she could go out onto the finance markets and raise money by borrowing to plug those gaps, and that she's too scared of doing so.
Look, the evidence is that she could, despite claims by Labour cabinet ministers that, you know, we were facing a run on the pound unless we immediately cut winter fuel payments. There's absolutely no evidence of any sort of financial markets panic that's about to start brewing. So yes, there is more room to borrow at this point in time. The challenge for government is that interest rates have gone up, the cost of borrowing has gone up, the cost of everything has gone up. And I would say looking long term, the cost of everything is likely to stay high into the future. One part of that is, as we keep getting told by various people, it is an ageing society. There is a bigger demand for care. There are all these different demands appearing in the NHS. Now, look, this is the centrality of the need to fund things like care properly, more than whether or not it's going to generate money and all the rest of it. It's part of how you build a good society. Can she fund this? Yes. One part of that, I think the obvious thing, they may do something on this. They may shift. I mean, the obvious one, if you want to do something big and that you would not find an economist really to disagree with this, is education. Education is obviously an investment, right? You can get people going to school. That produces a huge economic return. You can make similar cases, and people like the Women's Budget Group quite rightly do, for care in general, for all of these things producing a return. So you can start to move that. You can therefore open up more borrowing inside your fiscal rules. And also you can start to tax people.
What's really interesting about this conversation is I get the sense now that we are reaching sort of items of agreement, which definitely highlight shortcomings in the government's position. So the first thing is, it seems to me, you would like a change in the Treasury's relationship with the Bank of England. The second thing is you would like a substantial shift in this arbitrary division between everyday revenue spending and capital spending, right? Third thing, which leads on to that, which James mentioned a moment ago, is what should she do about the fiscal rules in the ideal world?
I have to say, John, that, you know, they are laughable. Every chancellor since, I don't know, Gordon Brown, since Alistair Darling, has adopted fiscal rules and always amends them, fits them to suit their own needs. There should only be one fiscal rule, and that is the government should aim for prosperity, for full employment. That will generate income and revenues needed to balance the books. And balancing the books is important, but you won't balance the books until you fix the economy.
James, is that your position on fiscal rules? Sounds like it probably is.
No, look, there's only one reason to introduce a fiscal rule, like underlying everything else. There's only one good reason anyway. There are several bad reasons, which is that you need to tie the Treasury's hands. You want a commitment device for the Treasury, who are at the heart of Britain's sort of institutional problems in terms of it being a low investment economy, excessively focused on the financial industry. Like, there's an institutional problem here. You need to tie its hands and say, this is a rule, you will deliver to this rule. What Rachel Reeves has done is the exact opposite, which is to take the fiscal rule and use this to enforce Treasury discipline on the rest of government, right? Okay. So she's done exactly the wrong thing with this. And it's a political economy device. It's not actually strictly necessary to have this at all. Government can spend more or less what it wants. Now, there are consequences to this somewhere down the line that you might want to avoid. But in principle, there's no reason why you can't just go out and, in the end, even just issue more money if you feel like it.
To finish, it seems to me, let's out of the realm of pure economics into politics, right? It seems to me that there is a set of very big risks to Labour's plans here. And that is very clear. It's that people in this country over the last 10 or 15 years, arguably since the crash of 2008, have been through a hell of a lot. I'm not sure you can watch people coping with the pandemic, a cost of living crisis, an eye-watering inflation, all the turbulence of Brexit, and then when they're finally promised change, not see change delivered. So they are still living in a world of litter everywhere and bankrupt councils and rusty swings in the park and everything else. And we only have to look at Germany very recently to know where disconnection and disgruntlement on the part of voters might lead. That's my fear, right? The stakes are very, very high here.
Yeah, I mean, the reason why there's this unrest, and let's note that it's not just reform in Britain, it's a global phenomenon. It's Donald Trump in the United States, it's Bolsonaro in Brazil. This authoritarianism, this nationalism is a rise, in my view, of ordinary people demanding protection from global markets that appear to be out of control. People are mad as hell at this global economic system that is doing this, not just here in Britain.
James, you must be worried as well along the lines that I've just outlined.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I think there is a slender route for Rachel Reeves to get through this budget and then maybe get some time afterwards where it doesn't look too bad. But what that looks like in 5 years' time, when you're not actually going to deliver the growth you needed because you'd put everything on delivering the growth, you hadn't raised taxes, you hadn't done these other reforms we talked about, you are not therefore going to be able to deliver the public spending required to keep things on the road, which is colossal. I mean, Lord McPherson, former Permanent Secretary of Treasury, says £50 billion a year extra minimum to sort of get you, where you want to be. And it's upwards from that once you start to think seriously about making things work. We're not even in the realm of that. So things are going to look bad. The one I'd throw in as well, and the one that we're not really used to thinking about as yet, is the colossal impact of climate change. This isn't a distant threat anymore. That's going to become a really serious problem over those next few years. And that looks like more costs for ordinary people, more economic turmoil, and a government that doesn't seem to be prepared to actually take the pretty bold steps you talked about to deal with any of it.
You used the B word. I was going to say this conversation is leading inevitably to that age-old Guardian clarion call, come on Labour, be bold. But it sounds like we mean it. Thank you for joining us, James and Anne.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, make sure you subscribe to Politics Week the UK wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby. The music is by Axel Kakoutier, and the executive producers are Maz Ebtahaj and Nicole Jackson.
This is The Guardian.
In Norway, a woman's boyfriend forgets who she is overnight. In Detroit, a man is arrested, but he was never at the crime scene. In Spain, disturbing pictures of young girls have appeared, and no one knows who's behind them. Something strange is happening. A collision between people and artificial intelligence.
Discover more in The Guardian series, Black Box. Listen to the whole series right now, wherever you get your podcasts.